Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to the Farm Report, and I'm your host today, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you live, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we are continuing our two-part series looking at chefs and farms and chefs who are farmers. And so we are joined in the studio today by George Weld and Evan Hanser of Parish Hall and Egg. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Awesome. I guess also, more importantly, and, you know, apropos to today's conversation of Goatfell Farm. So I thought we would start out a little bit of background on you guys for folks who maybe aren't super familiar with the restaurants. And I guess we'll start with you, George, if you can tell us a little bit about Egg and what you guys do there and how you got started.
Sure. We started Egg about almost 8 years ago, and it started off sort of squatting in another restaurant. So we were open in the mornings from 7 till noon, and the other restaurant would come in and take over. And we did that for about a year and a half. And after we'd sort of gotten some momentum, the other restaurant moved out, and we took over and started serving right through the day. And around the same time that we did that, we also bought a place upstate that we could use as a farm, which came out of probably out of a desire to. I mean, it's sort of a old desire of mine to be farming, but it was also something that a lot of the people who worked at Egg were excited about, and honestly kind of helped push us over the fence, my wife and I, like, into actually committing to doing it. So we started doing that in, I guess, 2007 or 2008, and just sort of been growing the farm slowly and carefully ever since then, trying to supply more and more stuff to the restaurants.
Awesome. Well, I want to definitely come back and tuck into some more of those details. But Evan, when did you kind of come on board with the team, and can you give us a sense of, like, what's happening over at Parish Hall?
Well, I came into Egg at the end of 2008, which was kind of the end of the first, I think, sort of real growing season that had been going on there. And then the following year, one of the servers in the restaurant, Chrissy, moved up to the farm and really started taking care of it full time, which she did for 2 years. So it was a really interesting time to be there because, you know, when I first heard about Egg, I'd heard about its commitment to, you know, sustainable food and using local farms, but I was able to arrive at a time where that was starting to be, that relationship was being moved in-house a little bit. So I got to, you know, it was amazing for me, you know, be able to go up to the farm, see these vegetables being grown, have them delivered directly to the restaurant, have requests about what we wanted to grow. And I think over the couple of years that I was at Egg and we had that relationship, the idea kind of based on our experience with that of working closely with a farm that was ours led to a new restaurant, which was Parish Hall. And so we opened Parish Hall last year, almost exactly a year ago. It's been great. It's been really exciting. And the idea behind Parish Hall was to explore Northeastern regional food with the same sort of sensibility and respect and creativity that Egg approaches Southern food. And a big motivation and inspiration for us was the farms in this region, the people we had met, you know, with in the process of running our own farm. And kind of, you know, figuring out how to take the things that these people were producing, these amazing products from meat to dairy to vegetables, and think about, you know, kind of like a new cuisine, you know, of this area, and try to push that forward with that as our starting point.
Nice. So, George, when you kind of were looking around, you decided, okay, hey, we're going to really do this. We're going to buy a farm. I mean, what were some of your first stops? Did you just, like, Google land for sale? Or, like, how did you kind of find a space to do the farm?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I did seriously was read through Elliot Coleman and like figure out. I really took him as a guide as far as like the New Organic Grower sort of is like big main book lays out very clear criteria for what you should look for in a farm. So I was looking for things that where the slope was just right, and you know where the growing area was on a plateau between a hill and a creek and stuff like that. And then, I mean, honestly, like I was at the restaurant so much, I didn't have much time to go hunting around. So my wife would spend the weekends driving around with our 2-year-old, trying to find a place that struck her, and coming back and saying, "We're not looking at that place. I know you'll fall in love with it, and I don't want to deal with it." But we finally found one place, and it had the land was situated nicely. It was in a town that we had some familiarity with. It had a smokehouse on it. It had a barn on it. The house was in decent shape. And there was enough land there. It looked like that we could grow as much stuff as we were going to need to grow to supply the restaurant. So kind of just jumped in. And it was right when the housing market began to collapse. So I don't know if we timed it just right or like terribly, but it was an interesting time for a lot of reasons to get in on it.
Was it being farmed when you looked to purchase it?
It
or?
Hadn't really been farmed. There's very little produce grown in that. We're in sort of the northeast part of Greene County. On the northeast side of the Catskills, not too far from Albany, it's very rocky or mountainous, and there's never been much vegetable production up there. So the people who had owned it before us had kind of like hobby animals. They'd had horses for a while, they'd had pigs. And when we were looking at it, they'd start to move to Florida, and they'd let the land lie fallow for at least a year. So it was just a gigantic lawn when we looked at it. I mean, like literally like 6 acres of shortcut grass. They'd had their lawnmower lowered after factory so they could keep the grass extra short. It was like a putting green. So there wasn't anything going on there when we got there, but when we started digging in, the soil was really rich. It had clearly been grazed before. We had a lot more topsoil than a lot of places in the area had. When I initially went around looking for deer fencing, nobody had it because there was no demand for it in the area. Nobody, like, people raised dairy cattle, they raised beef cattle, but
the deer weren't coming after the dairy cattle.
No, yeah, they just go alone.
Hello.
Yeah.
And what about financing? I mean, I know one of the biggest barriers for new farmers is finding kind of capital to purchase land. And so how did you guys like support that aspect? And did you run it through the restaurant business, or do you own the farm, or what's the structure there?
Yeah, my wife and I own the farm. In theory, the restaurant leases the land and stuff from us. Although there's, you know, it's really all theory. One of the other things that led us to look into it in the first place was we wanted to buy a place. We knew we could never afford anything in the city, so I guess we afford it by having cheap rent here. That's how we financed our farm, just having a lucky landlord.
And now, Evan, when you came onto the team at Egg and then subsequently, you know, launched the operation at Parish Hall, Did you have any background in growing food, or do you come to it, you know, more strictly as a chef who's a, you know, kind of discerning consumer of kind of produce and proteins?
I came to it more as a chef. The only experience I had growing anything was having some raised beds in my parents' backyard in Connecticut, which I'd gotten into, again, from a chef's perspective. Like I wanted to have the experience of growing food and have nice food, you know. That we were able to go into the backyard and pick. I grew up in a town that was really small, and had a few farms, so I had experience like being around farms, but I'd never had any experience working on one. In traveling up there, I'm not a farmer by any stretch of the imagination, but I've been able to learn a lot about the process and able to approach each year, I think, from a chef's perspective, a little bit more informed as to what's going on in the farm and what goes into it. So I can think about, when I'm thinking about dishes, I can know that it's going to be a couple months or before we're going to get this or that product. and I'm going to know how long we're going to have it, and I'll know that it'll be this way at the beginning of the season, it'll be this way at the end of the season. So,
yeah. Like some of your cooking, some of the, like the dish composition might change to a lot for the changes in the quality, or the, not, I don't want to say quality, but the characteristics
of that produce. Absolutely. And that was a big consideration in how we created the menu at Parrish Hall to start. We knew, because of the way we wanted to work, which was strictly with farmers in this area, and we knew that we'd be getting a lot of stuff from our farm, we'd have to have room to adjust, because things were not going to be consistent. You know, we couldn't count on the same size and shape of leaves coming in every week from the same purveyor. You know, we're going to have some variation, which led us to, you know, create a menu that would, one of the ways we thought about it, would, we want to create a menu that incorporates ingredients and has a sort of formula that makes sense, not just for us as cooks and chefs, where, you know, we could have consistency every time, but actually makes sense for farmers. Like, how is our menu going to be something that a farmer would like to, would make it easier for a farmer to sell to us if they have an ever-changing product?
Yeah, sure. And so, George, you definitely did research. You said we're primarily using Elliot Coleman and his work as a reference point. So transitioning from like sitting, you know, in your Brooklyn apartment reading the book to coming up to this, you know, green lawn, where did you start with, you know, what were kind of some of the first things that you did, and how has kind of the planning or layout of the farm kind of changed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, we started out just with a shovel and a rake, and the first year, my goal was to try to plant as much area as the footprint of Egg, which is, so it's 1,000 square feet. It's not a whole lot of, it's plenty of restaurant, but it's not much of a garden. But it was what we could manage with no power tools and not a whole lot of time or experience. So, and that was really just based on stuff I remembered from growing things in Virginia growing up, or, you know, it's pretty haphazard. The second year we did a lot more sort of real planning about like laying out areas and, you know, envisioning rotations. A lot of those didn't really pan out because someone else would go up to plant and not, you know, only read half the memo. And, you know, so I mean, I think one of the most amazing things that happened the first year was we planted the entire summer's worth of beets in one fell swoop, all the beets and all the lettuce in one fell swoop. So we had thousands and thousands and thousands of beets and heads of lettuce that all came ripe at once. So it sucked from a you know, having like a nice even rotation through the summer, but it was interesting to see, you know, you can harvest beets for a long time and you can leave them in the ground for a long time, and it was interesting to watch how they change. It was interesting to see how the lettuce changed over the course of the summer, and that led us to a lot of thoughts about the third year we did it, when we had an actual someone actually living up there full time. Thinking it through, plotting it out, and it helped us sort of have a sense of, you know, how much space, how much time to leave between rotations, and how much space to dedicate to various things, and how much lettuce could we actually use in a stretch, and so that third season was when we got very formal about rotations and successions and stuff, and I'll, you know, Chrissy went and studied with some people at Hawthorne Valley for a little bit to get some sense of it. But a lot of it, you know, a lot of it came through reading and experiments and keeping track of what we had done in the past and remembering what we'd done and seeing what worked.
Now, is the only outlet for what you're producing the restaurants?
Yeah.
So when you have kind of the bumper crop or kind of the crop that doesn't really pan out, you're kind of scrambling essentially to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're really lucky as a farm because we don't, I mean, the restaurants don't depend solely on what we have, so they can always go to the market and get other stuff. And it's no huge financial burden if we can't use everything we get. So we compost it or a lot. I mean, I would say probably more than anything, if we have more than we need of something, we'll just leave it in the ground and see what happens. I mean, it's interesting to see. I remember having this experience with a certain kind of butterhead lettuce the first year of like tasting it week after week after week. That year we had so much of it, and just tasting how it changed as the summer warmed up and as it stayed in the ground longer, and how it became more bitter, and how, you know, sometimes the bitterness was off-putting, but then you think about it in a different context and think of something else to do with it. So it was a kind of leisure that we have that a lot of other farmers don't have, because there was very little pressure on us to support ourselves as a farm.
And when we get like a surplus amount of beans or beets, when you're sending them down to a kitchen, obviously to a degree a farmer could do this as well, but we have people there who can process them and pickle them and store them to use later in the year, and we don't have that sort of stuff, and that's actually essential for us to do at Parish Hall especially. So it's kind of nice to have that relationship there. You know, we may not have all the space on the menu that given week for what we harvest, but for the most part we're able to put it up and keep it for a time when we are going to use it.
Yeah.
Kind of extend the season. Well, we are going to move to just a short break, and when we come back I want to talk a little bit more about the farm kind of in the kitchen and how that informs your work. So hang tight, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Maurice Narcisse by Eula on the heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Kane Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Kane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit kane5.com.
We are back. We are in studio with George Weld and Evan Hanser of Egg and Parish Hall. You're listening to The Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are talking about restaurants and farms and restaurants that have farms like you guys do. So one of the things I'm curious about, and you guys have touched on this a little bit, is how the aspect of growing food translates to the culture of your kitchen. I think both through the menu development, but also I'm more curious, like, for your staff in the front of the house, in the back of the house. I mean, what sets does that change the way people work or think about the food that they're working with, and in what ways?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, the produce we get from the farm is amazing. It's wonderful to work with from a cook's perspective, just because of the quality and the freshness of it. But I think the greatest benefit I would say we see out of having the farm is the way it changes our employees' perspectives and excites them about the work we do. We say to kind of anyone who asks this sort of question, that you'll see a marked difference in anyone who works for us who has gone up to the farm and come back to work, whether it's a cook or a server, because they've gone up there and they've seen the farm firsthand and been able to be out in the field and do a harvest or do some planting and put some work into the food that we're going to end up getting back at the restaurant. And that sort of experience and that memory has proven to be extremely strong for everyone who works with us. We always tell the story about a chef at Egg right now, Ed Quish, going up to the farm last year and planting two years ago, planting a ton of potatoes. And he was out in the sun all day, and he got like terribly sunburned. He was like hilling potatoes, really hard work. And I had set up this thing with Cornell to get us some potatoes that they were developing for New York soils, specifically. But I couldn't go up that weekend to help out. So of course everyone's like cursing me, like why did Evan order all these freaking potatoes? Like, this is ridiculous. He's not even here. And Ed came back all sunburned. He's working in the kitchen. And it's hot, and he can't stand to be in there. But when those potatoes finally got down to us after they'd grown, like it was such a like it brought back all those memories of working up there and being there months ago. And it's kind of like connecting to an earlier time in the year. And you know, when you put that much work into growing a potato, you're not gonna burn it. You're not gonna overcook it. You know, you're gonna treat it really carefully. And he did. And then I think in that way, like the food and the attention that's paid to it, improves just by, having that proximity to it, to where it comes from.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely, when I was cooking at Gramercy Tavern, went through these periods where I'm like, would look around my fellow line cooks. I'm like, you guys know that the food doesn't just come from the walk-in, right? Like, yeah. There's a multitude of steps before this. And, there's also a multitude of steps, I think, after it. Now, George, you just published this kind of interesting article in the Edible publication on closing the loop, where you're looking at, you know, the unspeakable, you know, parts of the nutrient cycle. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, people talk about, you know, growing food, distributing, you know, cooking it, but then there's like this whole waste issue. And even if you are cooking really carefully at a restaurant and making maximum use of kind of the produce or the proteins that you come in, there's still a fair amount of waste. And how do you kind of deal with that at the restaurants, and how does that connect with the farm if it does?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think most of the answer to this question, happily, is not unspeakable, but has a lot to do with the way that, I mean, as everyone's saying, like when you're actually working with the produce on both sides of the, you know, the delivery, you know, when you're planting it or harvesting it, when you bring it into the kitchen, you're much less, you understand that what an illusion consistency is, and how important it is, like when we talk about using things in their entirety, like how important it is, because it's exhausting to do that work in the first place. And, you know, you're not getting any, like, we're not getting anything else this week. This is it. So what are you going to do with it? Make the best of it. So I think, especially at Parish Hall, we're pretty, Evan does an amazing job of like finding ways to use everything. So so much of that has to do with getting past the idea of consistency and things being the same all the time. And, you know, being able to rely on, you know, putting the same thing on the menu every day. So that's a big part of it. And then, I don't know, beyond that, like, I think there's a much bigger kind of cultural discussion that has to happen about what happens to waste, because what happens to waste after it's gone through us as humans, when we, and the things that we put in our body that I think for me the crystallizing moment was sitting in the soil nutrition class at a farming conference and thinking about how we were trying to like reincorporate nutrients into the soil by using manure from animals or using compost, you know, which is the traditional way of thinking about how you deal with waste in restaurants. And we compost all our stuff at Egg and Parish Hall, and a lot of times we'll get stuff back up to the farm from there, and it's great. But these soil scientists were saying that, like, yeah, well, you know, it's not really doing the job. There's still a lot of nutrients leaving the cycle. And so the audience was kind of resisting this until they finally were like, no, basically when you go to the bathroom, that stuff's gone for good. That's not coming back to the soil. And everyone had this like quiet moment of like, whoa, I hadn't thought about it that way. And it's a pretty shocking thing to consider when you do start thinking about it, because all those things that we think about needing to reincorporate into the soil, you know, after, you know, cattle have grazed on grass or after you've trimmed your vegetables and put them in a compost bin, they make up a pretty small portion of what actually gets extracted from the soil when we grow stuff on it. I think it makes you think a little bit more about the extractive nature of agriculture. You know, even at its best, it's still withdrawing, like it's taking stuff out of the bank account, so to speak. And also about the sustainability of our waste system, and how we're going to think about dealing with what hits our sewage system, which has ramifications for, you know, everything from those, you know, the little signs you see on the painted on the sidewalk about, like, you know, don't pour stuff down the drain here, to, you know, medicine you take and the liquid plumber you pour down the drain. Like, all those things end up affecting our soil, which ends up affecting our ability to grow things healthily. I mean, it's a much bigger issue than I can even wrap my head around, but it's something I think we neglect to talk about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's like one of the challenges and one of the exciting things about being able to so come back to the table, so to speak, in these discussions around food production and consumption. It's a little naughty in that the more you know, the more you're like, shit, there's a lot I don't know, and there's all these other really big things to think about. And I mean, how do you prevent yourself from kind of getting overwhelmed? I mean, where do you go to seek refuge from kind of some of those pressures? I mean, is that a quiet space in the kitchen, or is it like eating a delicious, you know, piece of whatever, sharing it with someone? I mean, what's your like kind of quote unquote like happy place?
It might be, you know, in some ways the farm, you know, like going up there is, everyone will tell you, is like one of the more peaceful things you can do. Here, I think, you know, for me, it's oftentimes just either working in the kitchen, you know, with people, like when I'm like cleaning vegetables, you know, it's one of the more meditative times I have, you know, if I'm like peeling, right now we have baby shallots and green garlic, you know, just starting to come to the market and peeling off layers of that and trimming the roots and just thinking about spring right now is kind of like the moment where I feel like, all right, like things, everything, you know, no matter how many events we have or how much of this sort of like these issues with the food system are on my mind or who quit that week, you know, like that's the kind of stuff that could be pushed aside when you're just thinking about like the pleasures of doing this work, you know.
We sort of have a mantra at the kitchen in the restaurants. We approach everything like with an eye towards improving it. Sort of written over the doors of everything is improve everything you encounter. I think one of the sort of morally easy things about working in the food business is it's we came to it when it's so messed up, like from everything from, you know, labor relations to pollution to, you know, gas consumption. I mean, there's a million things you can look at that can overwhelm you. It's every one of those things is easy to improve a little bit, you know. And so, you know, when you get overwhelmed by the thought of the things you're, you know, flushing down the drain, you turn around and like figure out ways to, you know, treat the people you work with better or develop better relationships with your suppliers. I mean, we interact with so many different parts of the food system and with so many different people in it. And all of it needs to be improved on. Like there's no part of it that's perfect. I sort of think of it as like, we're sort of like on this lazy Susan. So I like turn around like, oh, we can do a little bit better with that. And then we'll go over here. It's like having a bunch of kids. Like you can't fix everybody at once, but you can fix a little bit of everything at a time.
Yeah. Well, that is one of the things that I would love to kind of hear your feedback on. You know, you mentioned earlier that the farm doesn't have the kind of pressure of quote unquote like needing to be successful in a financial, like the financial security of the farm is undergirded by things other than what you produce there. And then I think both of the restaurants that you run in Brooklyn are, you know, very lovely farm to table restaurants that people really love. And we've been having this kind of broader conversation here at the network with regards to, you know, sustainability and finding a balance between something that is can be held up as like a media darling. Oh, look at these great chefs and they're doing this farm to table and they have a farm and it's so awesome. And, you know, the reality behind that being like, what is the impact? Are those the right people to be giving press? Is that a model that we can scale in some way that makes sense? And I'm just curious like what your response to that kind of, you know, questioning might be.
Yeah, I mean, we wrestle with these questions all the time. I mean, even to the point like when we were talking about opening Parish Hall, we talked at times like, is this the right thing to do? Like, is this really, do we need restaurants? Are they good for the world? And in some cases I think the answer is like, well, we can do a better job of it. Like, they're going to be restaurants. We can do a better job of it than other people. So let's do it. We can be more just or more equitable. So let's do it. Let's give people a better option than what they've got. I think, you know, with the farm, one of our concerns initially that we've always sort of said, like, we don't want to replace the farmers that we use who do depend on, you know, who do have to sell all their produce. Like, it's never been a goal of ours to try to grow all of our own produce because we love the people that we work with who do, frankly, a better job at growing than we'll ever do because they're dedicated to it and they have been for a long time. I definitely think, you know, there's I think it's an important conversation to have. I think one of the things that we think about a lot with restaurants is whatever their problems are, they're able to employ a lot of people. And we can do, we need jobs, and we need good jobs. And so a lot of our focus has been on trying to make the jobs that we give people good jobs and make sure that they are jobs that people feel like they can settle into and not that they're just trying to do for a while, you know, when they're in their early 20s, burn themselves out and then move on to something else, a quote unquote real job. But really to say, like, we're working in food, restaurants can touch on every part of it. How can we make this work fulfilling, sustainable for every one of us individually, make it work as a business overall? And I mean, I think it's hard to squeeze enough money out of any part of this to make you feel like we're all sitting pretty and feeling great about everything. I still look at people who work in the kinds of environments I used to work in, who make tons more money than any of us will ever make doing what I was like, we don't need people doing that kind of work, and you don't work that hard. Like, it's frustrating to see where money lands, but it's also important, I think, to remember that we're getting that we are having an impact, and that the stuff that we do matters, and that when we leave work at night, we don't have to think like, well, someday I'll get around to doing something that I'll make a difference. Like, we're doing it. It may not always be perfect, and it may not be the best solution, but I think it's better than what it's better than a lot of things.
yeah. And well, we are just about out of time. I know, Evan, you have a kind of a fun event coming up this evening, right?
Tonight, yeah, we're involved with a fundraiser for Brooklyn Grange Community Farming Program. We work with them really closely, and we're doing a fundraiser at the Brooklyn Brewery called the Meatball Slapdown. It's a bunch of different restaurants. I know the Pines, Buttermilk Channel, I think Mile End is going to be there. We're all making different types of meatballs. People are going to show up and eat them and choose a winner, and then all that, you know, all that's going to benefit a couple of charities. So we're pretty excited about that. I know you're just talking to Ben, you know, before this, so it'd be cool to see him tonight.
Yeah, definitely. I think tickets are $50. They're still available. You can get them through, I know, Brooklyn Kitchen, and probably just do a little Google for the meatball
slap down.
Yeah. then you'll be all set with your plans for the evening. Well, George, Evan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So if you want to find out more about Egg Parish Hall or Goat Fall Farm, you can visit them, www.eggrestaurant.com or parishhall.com or goatfellfarm.com. As always, this, like all 30 of our weekly shows, are available for free as a download through iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher Smart Radio or visit the website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you like what you hear and believe in what we do, I hope you'll consider clicking that donate tab and becoming a member today. Stay tuned in. Next week on the Farm Report, we'll be talking mushrooms. So Thursday, 1 o'clock, hope to see you back here.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. What's hot at the Green Market? You're about to find out now. It's the Grow NYC Market Update.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. This is another episode of the Grow NYC Market Update. We are on the line with Liz Carollo, and we are about to kick off our new series, exploring the neighborhood market. So I'm excited, Liz, to hear what we'll be starting off with.
Great. Yeah, I'm going to start off with my own neighborhood, my home market, the Greenpoint McCarran Park Green Market. It's located in the heart of McCarran Park, smack in the middle of the dog run and the running track and soccer field, just north of Williamsburg, between Williamsburg and Greenpoint. The market opened in 1997, so it's going on its 16th season this year. And we only have a handful of markets that are street closures, and this is one of them. So it makes for a really wide walking space in between the farm stands and plenty of room for a diverse group of farmers. There's also a really large courtyard with tables and chairs adjacent to the market, so plenty of places to take a load off and drink some coffee after your shopping trip.
Nice, nice. And so who are the kind of farmers and products that we can expect to find at this market?
Yeah, I was thinking about this earlier, and I remembered a story from a couple years ago. I was walking through the market doing some shopping, and I overheard a girl say, "This market is okay, but a little small, nothing like Union Square." And I swear I wanted to shake her and just yell, "Open your eyes. The market has tremendous diversity, really affordable produce from the Black Dirt region of Orange County from SNSO Farm, organic vegetables and eggs from Long Island, organic beef, pork and chicken, consider Broadwell cheese, turkey and turkey sausage, mushrooms, red jacket fruit and juices, Ronnie Brook milk and yogurt, baked goods, Cayuga Pure Organics breads, flours and grains, cut flowers, plants and herbs, and it boasts a weekly food scrap and textile collection. So I'd pass up the chaos of Union Square Saturday any old day for the serenity of a Brooklyn farmer's market, especially one where I can get all my shopping done.
Nice. So, well, aside from kind of avid market goers like yourself, what's the vibe at the market there? Like, who are shopping? What's the general makeup of the market goers?
Yeah, the market bridges the burgeoning Williamsburg neighborhood and the Polish neighborhood of Greenpoint. So you're bound to see a lot of families, kids and dogs. I call our weekend markets kids and dogs markets because it seems to be what they're full of. Sometimes those families are lingering for hours, catching up with friends and neighbors, participating in market events and activities. There's also a lot of Polish families who get out early and shop, loading up on cucumbers for pickle making and honey and bee products. And last year we hosted a borscht cook-off with a couple of Greenpoint restaurants, all made with local beets, of course. I think sometimes it just takes some delicious borscht to overcome a language barrier.
I am ready to sign up for that experiment anytime, any place.
It was great. Yeah, it was really fun.
So say folks, are coming out to the neighborhood to check out this market. I mean, how can they really like make a day of it? What else is going on around the market?
Yeah, we're trying to do a big push this year and get people to visit markets in other neighborhoods and, not just to go to the market, but to kind of see the neighborhood and check out some of the other restaurants and things to do. And there's no shortage of fun stuff going on in Williamsburg and Greenpoint. Right next to the market is Urban Rustic, and you'll see the farmers wheeling over boxes of produce all day. They buy from a lot of our producers. They have coffee and really tasty food. Other neighborhood food spots that are devoted to the market are George Weld, and I just heard him on the Farm Report. We're big fans of George. So Egg and Parish Hall, Liza Queen's Pot Liquor, Marlowe and Sons and Diner, Salty has incredible sandwiches, the Always Fun and Filling Smorgasburg along the waterfront. One of my favorites is a restaurant in Greenpoint called Eat. It's awesome, and they even have a CSA pickup spot there, and they're almost 100% devoted to buying local. And, of course, any number of places to get kielbasa and pierogies along Manhattan Avenue and Greenpoint. And then when you're adequately stuffed and ready to burn it all off, there's the sprawling McCarran Park, the new McCarran Pool, which is huge and free, open in the summertime. Of course, taking a dip is perfect summer activity. Also nearby is the Newtown Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant, which I admit doesn't sound like the most inviting place, but it really is beautiful. They host a quarter-mile nature walk along the water and gets points for also being educational. You can learn about wastewater treatment and harbor water quality while you stroll. And I would be remiss not to mention the Brooklyn Kitchen, only a hop, skip, and jump away from the market, one of my favorite places to kill a few hours attending any number of their food-centric classes and shopping for kitchen equipment. And City Reliquary, a really fun Williamsburg museum. They have a collection of New York City artifacts, and then they have community members who show off their collections for certain times. I think the entry fee is like 50 cents, so no breaking the bank while visiting that museum.
Nice. Awesome. Well, it's a great kind of little purview, and I suppose folks can expect over the course of the next couple of weeks on the market update to hear about a slew of other neighborhood markets. So I'm really looking forward to kind of exploring and then exploring.
Great.
As far as, you know, events and kind of general market happenings, what else should we have on the radar?
Yeah, it's coming up in a couple weeks, but April 17th at Cinema Village, our director, Michael Hurwitz, will be sitting on a panel after a screening of a movie called American Meat, talking about industrial meat production in the country and kind of our answer to that. He'll be on the panel with farmers Mike Yezzi, restaurateur Peter Hoffman, and Robert LaValva, and the panel discussion is going to be focused on markets in New York City. So that'll be really interesting to see those four speak, and I highly recommend people pick up their tickets now, because I think it's going to sell out. Also coming into the market in the next couple of weeks, Ramps. We hear they're right around the corner. This week I saw Wintered Over Broccoli Rob picked some up. It's my favorite spring ingredient. So glad it's finally here. I made broccoli rob pesto for the first time last night. It was so good. And then we're doing Farmer Appreciation Month kind of at all of the markets. And at Union Square this week, you can pick up cards that we've pre-made and sign them and fill something out and say something nice to your farmer and hand them off. And then April 20th, as we're approaching Earth Day, we're going to have 11 Madison Park. Very excited about this. Host a book signing, and they're going to be giving out samples of food at Union Square starting at 10 a.m. on April 20th. And that's going to be a preliminary event leading up to Food Book Fair, which will take place in Brooklyn in early May. But we're going to start spreading the word about that soon. I highly recommend people get informed about Food Book Fair and look on their website and plan on going to that.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Great. Thanks for the great update, and look forward to checking in again next week.
Great. Thanks, Erin.
All right. So if you want to find out all the details of what's happening at all of the markets across the city, definitely check them out by visiting grownyc.org/ourmarkets. You can also stay up to date by following them on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, or whatever your preferred social media. And as always, tune in every Thursday for another episode of the Grow NYC Market Update.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. This is Rooftop Farming with Ben Flanner, a weekly update on heritageradionetwork.org live from the Brooklyn Grange.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. We are on the line with Ben Flanner, founder of the Brooklyn Grange, and we are excited to hear on this beautiful spring day what is shaking over at the farm.
Right. Hey, Erin.
How's it going?
It's going good. There's a lot shaking. We're excited to feel like the weather's taking a little bit of a turn for the warmer. We got seeds germinating all over the place. But especially starting last week, once we got a couple warm, sunny days. To start, first of all, with the outdoor, the direct sown bed, which includes lettuces, different salad greens, radishes, and Japanese turnips. They're all popping, and some of those have been in the ground for almost a month. But if they don't get the perfect temperatures or the environment where it warms up enough during the day, which we didn't really get, they all come. So we're going to have a good strong wave of that stuff, which will be coming in about 25 days or so. We also have carrots and peas in the ground, but they're not up yet, but that's not untypical because they take a little bit longer and they were put in a little bit more recently.
And
so we're excited. What's that?
Sorry, I feel like a little silly asking this, but when you say, you know, the seeds have germinated, what exactly does that mean?
That means that, so when we put a seed into the ground, you give it moisture, you give it the proper temperature and the proper environment, which means not too moist, because if you really soak it, like if it's in sitting water, it'll die. And if it dries out too much, then it'll also die. So you apply a proper amount of moisture to it, and then after typically between, say, 5 to 15 days, depending on the seed, it'll germinate, meaning that it pops and a tiny little sprout comes out. And you typically have the seeds in the ground between, say, a quarter inch to an inch, depending on the type of seed, so buried underneath. And then the little sprout comes out, it pushes for the light and the sun, and it emerges out of the soil.
Got it. Thanks.
You are welcome. So speaking of germinating, lots more of that going on in the hoop house, where we have the seeds that are in there need a little bit warmer temperature. And those are the tomatoes, the peppers, and the eggplants, and they've all been coming up. We've had thousands of them germinate in their little seedling trays. And then also, which something else that we started in the hoop house, which I spoke about several weeks ago, was the kale. And this is now the fifth week of it since we planted it, and we started taking that outside. So we planted them in the black seedling trays, which are 10 inches by 20 inches, so they're a rectangular plastic tray, and each one of them has 98 cells in it. So it's fairly small little holes for each kale seed. If you were to imagine it, it's 17 going the long way along the 20-inch span, and then 14 going along the long way, and then 7 going along the narrow way. And we put one seed in each cell, and kale has a really high germination rate, so we got at least 95% germination, meaning pretty nearly every cell has one healthy plant in it. And this week we were looking at them, and the ways that you test are by looking at the root ball that's underneath in the soil and seeing if that's starting to really fill up the volume that's available to it, and then also looking at the leaf that is out of the soil. And the leaf was probably about 4 inches tall by now. It has the seed leaf, which is the natural leaf that comes out with the seed, and then it starts to develop what we call the true leaves. And they're different shaped, and you can clearly tell the difference between them. And it's starting to develop 2 to 4 true leaves, and the stem's getting a little bit stronger, and the root's starting to fill up the volume of its cell. So we took them outside, and we planted about 1,000 kale plants into the outdoor area yesterday. So just to go a little bit more into detail about how we do that, I thought that would be interesting. So we prepare our beds, and our beds are 40 inches wide. And these ones that we put them in were probably about 40, 50 feet long, maybe 60 feet long. And we till in the cover crop, make sure that any significant healthy roots are turned up or killed, so they're not going to compete with the crop that we're putting in. And then we blend in just a very small amount of alfalfa meal, which is a natural, organic, mostly a nitrogen provider. It basically will break down in there. And then we also put about half inch to an inch of fresh compost on the top of the bed. We rake that in. And this compost was unique. It's good compost that we made, but also at the same time, we weren't sure if it had reached quite the high enough temperatures to kill all the seeds that can be in it, because when we make our compost, we put tomatoes, tomatillos, tons of different weeds, peppers, all these different inputs, and many of them contain seeds. And if the compost doesn't reach a hot enough temperature, you don't know for sure if all the seeds are dead. So if you top dress with that, meaning you put an inch or so on top of the bed, and there are a lot of seeds, especially once it starts to turn a lot warmer, they will compete with the crop that you're trying to grow. So as a sort of buffer to that, we still took the risk and used this compost, whereas we could have cured it for another year or something like that to kill more seeds. Then we top dressed that with chocolate husk, which we picked up from the Mass Brothers last week. And it's basically the byproduct of making chocolate. It's from Williamsburg. It's a waste product that they'd be throwing away otherwise. And the shells on the outside are very dry, they're very heavy, and they contain some nitrogen. And they can also suppress the weeds if you put a little layer of them down. And they also contain moisture. It's essentially a mulch. It's a nice mulch to use. So we put all those layers on, rake it out real smooth, and then we dig little holes and put in the kale plants. And we'll keep you posted on how they're doing.
Awesome. Wow. Thanks for taking us through the replanting process, and look forward to keeping an eye with you on the kale plants. How long do you think roughly before we'll be able to get a little taste of some?
Probably about a month. When you transplant a plant like that, kale goes through about 1 week of transplant shock, meaning that it takes about a week for it to establish in its new home, and the roots will kind of just be spreading out and trying to get their bearings. and you won't see a lot of change in the leaves. But all of a sudden, after that week, maybe 8-9 days, then they'll really start taking off, and it'll be an amazing growth curve because the days will be starting to get longer. Then, too, we'll be into mid to late April. And by May, we'll definitely be getting some harvest off of it. Today's April 4th.
Awesome. Great. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us. And I definitely encourage folks out there, if you want to learn more about the Grange or get involved at the farm, visit them at www.brooklyngrange.com. And tune in next Thursday. We'll bring you another rooftop update. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.